2 Samuel chapter 19, the whole chapter. Job was told, "The king is weeping and mourning for Absalom, and for the whole army. The victory that day was turned into mourning, because on that day the troops heard it said, 'The king is grieving for his son.' The men stole into the city that day, as men steal in who are ashamed when they flee from battle. The king covered his face and cried aloud, 'O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son.' Then Job went into the house to the king and said, 'Today you have humiliated all your men who have just saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines. You love those who hate you and hate those who love you. You have made it clear today that the commanders and their men mean nothing to you. I see that you would be pleased if Absalom were alive today and all of us were dead. Now go out and encourage your men. I swear by the Lord that if you don't go out, not a man will be left with you by nightfall. This will be worse for you than all the calamities that have come upon you from your youth till now.' So the king got up and took his seat in the gateway. When the men were told, 'The king is sitting in the gateway,' they all came before him. Meanwhile, the Israelites had fled to their homes. Throughout the tribes of Israel, the people were all arguing with each other, saying, 'The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies. He is the one who rescued us from the hand of the Philistines. But now he has fled the country because of Absalom. And Absalom, whom we anointed to rule over us, has died in battle. So why do you say nothing about bringing the king back?' King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests: 'Ask the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his palace, since what has been said throughout Israel has reached the king at his quarters? You are my brothers, my own flesh and blood. So why should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my own flesh and blood? May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if from now on you are not the commander of my army in place of Joab.' He won over the hearts of all men of Judah as though they were one man. They sent word to the king, 'Return, you and all your men.' Then the king returned and went as far as the Jordan. Now the men of Judah had come to Gilgal to go out and meet the king and bring him across the Jordan. Shimei, son of Gera, the Benjamite from Bahurim, hurried down to the men of Judah to meet King David. With him were 1,000 Benjamites, along with Ziba, the steward of Saul's household, and his 15 sons and 20 servants. They rushed to the Jordan, where the king was. They crossed at the ford to take the king's household over and to do whatever he wished. When Shimei, son of Gera, crossed the Jordan, he fell prostrate before the king and said to him, 'May my lord not hold me guilty. Do not remember how your servant did wrong on the day my lord the king left Jerusalem. May the king put it out of his mind. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. But today I have come here as the first of the whole house of Joseph to come down and meet my lord the king.' Then Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said, 'Shouldn't Shimei be put to death for this? He cursed the Lord's anointed.' David replied, 'What do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah? This day you have become my adversaries. Should anyone be put to death in Israel today? Do I not know that today I am king over Israel?' So the king said to Shimei, 'You shall not die.' And the king promised him on oath. Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, also went down to meet the king. He had not taken care of his feet or trimmed his mustache or washed his clothes from the day the king left until the day he returned safely. When he came from Jerusalem to meet the king asked him, 'Why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth?' He said, 'My lord the king, since I, your servant, am lame,' I said, I will have my donkey saddled, and I will ride on it, so I can go with the king. But Ziba, my servant, betrayed me, and he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. My lord the king is like an angel of God, so do whatever pleases you. All my grandfather's descendants deserve nothing but death from my lord the king, but you gave your servant a place among those who eat at your table. So what right do I have to make any more appeals to the king? The king said to him, "Why say more? I order you and Ziba to divide the fields." Mephibosheth said to the king, "Let him take everything, now that my lord the king has arrived home safely." Barzillai the Gileadite also came down from Rogelim to cross the Jordan with the king and to send him on his way from there. Now Barzillai was a very old man, 80 years of age. He had provided for the king during his stay in Mahanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. The king said to Barzillai, "Come, cross over with me and stay with me in Jerusalem, and I will provide for you." But Barzillai answered the king, "How many more years will I live that I should go up to Jerusalem with the king? I am now 80 years old. Can I tell the difference between what is good and what is not? Can your servant taste what he eats and drinks? Can I still hear the voices of men and women singers? Why should your servant be an added burden to my lord the king? Your servant will cross over the Jordan with the king for a short distance, but why should the king reward me in this way? Let your servant return, that I may die in my own town, near the tomb of my father and mother. But here is your servant Kimham. Let him cross over with my lord the king. Do for him whatever pleases you." The king said, "Kimham shall cross over with me, and I will do for him whatever pleases you. And anything you desire from me, I will do for you." So all the people crossed the Jordan, and then the king crossed over. The king kissed Barzillai and gave him his blessing, and Barzillai returned to his home. When the king crossed over to Gilgal, Kimham crossed with him. All the troops of Judah and half the troops of Israel had taken the king over. Soon all the men of Israel were coming to the king and saying to him, "Why did our brothers, the men of Judah, steal the king away and bring him and his household across the Jordan together with all his men?" All the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, "We did this because the king is closely related to us. Why are you angry about it? Have we eaten any of the king's provisions? Have we taken anything for ourselves?" Then the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, "We have 10 shares in the king, and besides, we have a greater claim on David than you have. So why do you treat us with contempt? Were we not the first to speak of bringing back our king?" But the men of Judah responded even more harshly than the men of Israel.
Last week, we read that accompanied by 20,000 other casualties as a result of the conflict between the forces of Israel and King David's men, the egotistical Absalom, David's son, the pretender to the throne, is now dead. The coup has failed, and failed miserably, as David's loyal troops had prevailed against a much larger but less proficient army. And now they look forward with great anticipation to meeting their king, who they love and who they have so gallantly fought for and rescued from certain death. And there's also little doubt that the air of expectation of meeting their king, who was safely hiding in the city of Mahanaim, was that they would be showered with praise, congratulations, appreciation for all their valiant and successful effort. But when they arrived at the place where David had taken refuge, as verse 3 has it, it was not to be. The men stole into the city that day as men who are ashamed when they flee from battle. Now, why was this so? Well, before arriving at the city, they had been made privy to the news But when David had heard of the demise of Absalom, rather than being overjoyed at the success of his troops, he was in a state of such deep distress and mourning that he was found to be weeping and totally unconcerned about anything else, including the giving of his brave warriors their due. Joab, David's army general, noticed that if David continued to allow his grief to prevent him from recognising the efforts of his men, then David would pay the price of losing their respect and loyalty. And so Joab, perceptively and probably also courageously, decided to take the chance of rebuking David with the words which we find in verses 5 to 7. Today you have humiliated all your men who have just saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines. You love those who hate you and hate those who love you. You have made it clear today that the commanders and their men mean nothing to you. I see that you would be pleased if Absalom were alive today and all of us were dead. Now go out and encourage your men. I swear by the Lord that if you don't go out, not a man will be left with you by nightfall. This will be worse for you than all the calamities that have come upon you from your youth till now. Now, David may have reacted badly to this rebuke and this exhortation, and he may have taken serious offence, and who knows? And who knows what might have happened then? But to his credit, David doesn't take offence, and we have his rather positive and commendable reaction in verse 8. So the king got up and took his seat in the gateway. When the men were told, "The king is sitting in the gateway," they all came before him. And as a result of this, all was well. Now I think that there is nothing quite so sweet as the reconciliation of those who, for whatever reason, are at odds with one another. In passages like this, when we are examining these events and the way that the main characters are behaving, we have to remember that we are not just dealing with what we might call the average person. We are dealing with national leaders. We are dealing with kings and princes and the like. We are dealing with the people who have very important and responsible positions in what we might call the leadership team of a nation. If we take this into consideration, then we must conclude that David's reaction to the death of his traitorous and arrogant son was natural enough from the viewpoint of a father, though apparently not a very good one. But when viewed within the context of David's sovereign and leadership position, it becomes somewhat self-indulgent as he allows his personal grief to get in the way of his other equally important and maybe more important duties and responsibilities. So we might conclude that at this point he owed Joab a similar debt to that which he owed the prophet Nathan, who also had the insight and the courage to give him some necessary and good advice as well after his adulterous affair with Bathsheba and the role he played in the murder of Uriah. There can be very little doubt that we are all a very strange and complex mixture of personality traits. And David was no different. Here we see the king, the great warrior, the Lord's anointed, acting in a way which belies his high position and calling, and which consequently almost loses him the respect and the loyalty of the dedicated men of his army. And we might justly criticise him for that. But the same man, when berated and severely rebuked by the likes of his army general Joab, rather than respond in a tormented rage, as he may well have done, doesn't do that. No. But rather he calmly accepts the criticism, he calmly accepts the rebuke, and responds to it in a humble and gracious manner. So in this short cameo, we see both the weakness and the strength of the same man. Maybe when we make our assessments of one another, we might consider whether we know one another sufficiently well enough before we presume to make our judgments and decide on a final and lasting opinion. One or two isolated mistakes in a person's life does not necessarily render their life as being unproductive or useless. If someone, however, keeps on making the same mistake over and over again, then we may have good cause to be concerned. But sometimes I think we may be inclined to be a little bit too quick on the draw and too anxious to fire our deadly bullets. However, on the other hand, when we are similarly rebuked for our ultimate benefit, we should not be too quick to resent those who may very well have our best interest at heart. And maybe we should also remember that God does not only speak to us through those who we necessarily like. And sometimes, very good advice, though maybe unwittingly, might come to us from those who just don't like us at all. So let's be careful and always willing to listen and be corrected and examine what is said to us in the light of the gospel of God. Well now, all is well with David and his troops, and although the reconciliation is complete, he is still not out of the woods, for surprisingly, he does not immediately return to Jerusalem. The question now on his mind is this: will I be welcomed? But unknown to David, we have this in verses 9 to 10. Throughout the tribes of Israel, the people were all arguing with each other, saying, "The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies. He is the one who rescued us from the hand of the Philistines. But now he has fled to the country because of Absalom. And Absalom, whom we appointed to rule over us, has died in battle. So why do you say nothing about bringing the king back?" The king had taken refuge in the city of Mahanaim, a city on the other side, that is the eastern side, of the Jordan River. Israel had a serious change of heart. These 10 tribes which made up this part of Israel, which excluded Judah, these 10 tribes were in a state of disarray. Consequently, the men of Israel changed their minds about David. And as a result of this, there was widespread recognition of the need to bring David back to Jerusalem to resume his sovereign duties. So now, David will again be faced with the challenge of rebuilding the nation of Israel, which had been split rather severely by this attempted and failed coup. But we must not ignore the obvious fickleness of the people. One minute, they are for David. Then it's Absalom. But now Absalom is dead. So where do we go from here? Oh, well, let's go back to David. He's not so bad after all. look what he's done for us in the past. I hope that we as a church group might not be as erratic and as unprincipled as this in the way that we treat our church leaders. So let's give our church leaders the loyalty and the respect that their positions merit. On the other hand, may our church leaders be spiritually mature and sufficiently interested enough in the ones that they are appointed to lead to make every effort to earn the trust given to them by giving the people good and faithful leadership so that the church may be led in a godly manner. This will ensure that everyone is treated the same. This will ensure that everyone is given an equal opportunity to exercise the ministries given to them in an approving and a safe environment. However, though Israel was keen to reinstate the king, the men of Judah gave the impression that they were not so eager. David had become privy to the good disposition of the men of Israel towards him, but was perplexed that there was nothing from the elders of Judah. So, what did he do? Well, he recruited the priests Zadok and Abiathar, who remained in Jerusalem while David was hiding from Absalom. And he did this to try and find out what the elders of Judah were up to, because these men would be in a good position to know what had gone on there during his absence. Take a look at verses 11 to 15. King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Ask the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to invite the king back to his palace, since what is being said throughout Israel has reached the king at his quarters? You are my brothers, my own flesh and blood. So why should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my own flesh and blood? May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if from now on you are not the commander of my army in place of Joab. He won over the hearts of all the men of Judah as though they were one man. They sent word to the king, return, you and all your men. Then the king returned and went as far as the Jordan. Now in verse 12 we have this. David appeals to their sense of community within the family. You are my brothers, my own flesh and blood, so why should you be the last to bring back the king? As well, giving Amasa, who was previously Absalom's general, Joab's job, was a very intriguing move and demonstrated that David was at his administrative best. This move assured that all those who had fought on Absalom's side, including those from Judah, that there would be no recriminations and that there would be no grudges held against them. And this gesture also played a major part in winning over the hearts of all the men of Judah and winning them back from their allegiance to Absalom. And maybe it was also a way of punishing Joab for killing Absalom. For Amasa, however, it seems as though it was going to be a mixed blessing, as we shall see when we study chapter 20. So what do we have now? Well, we have this. David is reconciled to his army. He is reconciled to Israel. He is reconciled to Judah. As we have been so correctly and often reminded, God's anointed king is not perfect, but he is one of God's men in the history of redemption. And God's Spirit is leading him in a wonderful and conciliatory way as these post-war events unfold. It is clear, is it not, that to properly establish himself again in his royal position as king of all Israel, David is faced with the same challenge, as you may remember, that he was faced with back in chapter 8. Back then, after having defeated all of Israel's enemies, he had to consolidate the whole of Israel into a cohesive national group. And he did this by making wise administrative decisions and appointments. And it appears that he will be as successful now as he was then. So David begins to make his way back to Jerusalem. On the way, he and his men had to cross the Jordan River near Gilgal. And the people of Judah came out in force to escort him back across from the eastern side of the river, thus giving their approval of his imminent return to Jerusalem to resume his kingly duties. But they were not the only ones present, for unsurprisingly, in verse 17, we discovered that Ziba, Mephibosheth's steward, was also there with his entourage. Now, what was he up to, we might ask? Well, to find out, we have to go back to chapter 16 and verses 1 to 4, where, among other things, Ziba had told some lies about Mephibosheth, thus slandering him in order to seek some material benefit for himself, which he successfully achieved. Remember verse 3, where in response to David's questions to Ziba, asking as to the whereabouts of Mephibosheth, Ziba replied untruthfully, "He is staying in Jerusalem." That is, he hasn't joined David in his strategic withdrawal from Jerusalem. Because, and here's the lie, because he thinks, "Today the house of Israel will give me back my grandfather's," that is Saul's, "kingdom." We aren't actually told, but perhaps Ziba is concerned that it wouldn't be long before Mephibosheth would also appear on the scene as well. And perhaps he wants to get into David's ear first in order to protect himself. In verse 24, Mephibosheth does appear. And in verses 26 to 27, he counters Ziba's previous lie with the truth. And as these two men faced off with one another in the presence of their king, David once again achieved a reconciliation by wisely settling their dispute and also spares Ziba from any violent repercussions. But that's not all. Someone else, even more unexpected, also appears as well. A Benjamite, a man by the name of Shimei. And he doesn't come alone, for he is accompanied by 1,000 other Benjamites in a show of mass support for David. Note the calm, rational man pictured here in verses 18 to 20, who had no reservations about prostrating himself before the king, seems to be far removed from the ranting and raving character of the earlier encounter. Shimei appears to have been alone when he previously staged his aggressive attack by throwing insults, stones and dirt at David as David fled from Jerusalem, back in verses 5 to 14 of chapter 16. So what is he up to now? Well, perhaps he came with a genuine repentance for his previous behaviour. However, it is also possible that the men of the town in which Shimei lived pressured him to come and apologise, and they had come along to make sure that he did. And all this to counter their fear of the possibility that David might punish the whole town for Shimei's previous offence. Either way, his apology is graciously accepted, and he receives David's generous assurance that there will be no recriminations for his previous misdemeanor, and thus the two men, along with the whole city, are also beautifully reconciled to one another. Then finally, there's David's generous gesture of appreciation to Barzillai, who showed such charitable hospitality to David while in Mahanaim during his temporary exile from Jerusalem. So there we are. And even though the chapter finishes with Judah and Israel still sorting out some serious ongoing issues, this chapter contains a very strong message about the Christian virtue of reconciliation, while contrasting it with the vice of venomous conflict and calamity dealt with in the previous two chapters. As I have indicated on previous occasions, we only properly understand events like these within the context of the redemptive history of which David, the son of Jesse, played a significant role. In this chapter, we see him at his peacemaking best. And this gives us a cameo of what the gospel of God is all about. It is clear, is it not, that the gospel is about God's work of reconciliation. Initially, the reconciliation of people with God himself through the repentance of their sins and faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. And then, the reconciliation of people with one another. It seems to me that the Christian life is all about reconciliation and relationships. It is clear, is it not, that how we relate to other people, friend or foe, is one of the vital tests of our Christianity. If we think that we are God's people because we say we believe certain things about God and about Jesus, and because we have done certain things, but have no regard for our relationships, or play fast and loose with our relationship with our fellow man, and particularly with our Christian brothers and sisters, then I would suggest to you that we haven't even begun to understand what the Christian life is all about, no matter what else we may be able to lay claim to. Now, my friends, I will leave it at that, for this is a study all of its own, so I won't keep you any longer. So I will conclude by allowing the Apostle John to have the last word, by reading verses 9 to 11 from chapter 1 of 1 John. Anyone who claims to be in the light but hates his brother is still in the darkness. Whoever loves his brother lives in the light, and there is nothing in him to make him stumble. But whoever hates his brother is in the darkness and walks around in the darkness. He does not know where he is going because the darkness has blinded him. Amen.